5 a.m. on Monday, January 24, 2011. Will the House Secretary call the roll?
Here.
Representative
Feige.
Here.
Representative Cook.
Here.
Representative Sisson.
Representative
Kawasaki.
Here.
Chair Dick.
Here. And, yes, Representative Sisson is excused for medical reasons. A quorum is present to conduct business. And this time I'd like to remind everybody, including myself, to turn off cell phones and address questions to the chair. Okay, I think we have a pretty exciting day today, but I would like to remind all of us that even as we're meeting this morning, just in K-12, we have 129,000 students getting ready for school today. We have 7,000 teachers getting ready for school today. And that's just K-12, and our responsibility is broader than that. And the decisions we make today and for the rest of this year are going to be very important in the lives and the future of those people. We need to always just have that mental picture of those young people out there that really need us to make some good decisions. If we get this morning today, we're going to have a discussion with the Department of Education and Early Development. And if we could have Acting Commissioner Les Morse come and join us, and anybody you'd like to have anybody to present with you.
But I am going to introduce people, but they do not need to come to the table at this time.
Representative Tammy Wilson's in the back. If you'd like to join us, Representative Wilson, you're more than welcome to. Okay. Okay, this is a prompt. Last week, I, in communicating with the Department of Education and Early Development, I just posed six questions. They weren't firm questions that needed to be, had to be answered, but they were just maybe a guideline for the presentation this morning so we can all get that big picture that we spoke about last week. I'll read those questions. Well, the first one was, what is DED and how is it structured? What is the overarching educational philosophy? Give a brief history of education in Alaska, and as I read what was prepared, I was educated. And what are the differences and similarities between and among the rural, bush, and urban schools? And give an overview of the DEED budget and how it works, and what does DEED perceive to be the problems in education, and what would they like of us the legislature? So this session of the legislature to address, as I reflect on the governor's State of the State message, there was one word that stood out, and that was together. And I really hope that we can do that. That'll be a focus for us. So Acting Commissioner Morris, if you'd like to begin, and why don't you describe what you described to me as how you'd like this to how we'd like this to go.
Thank you, Chair Dick. And for the record, my name is Les Morse. I'm currently the Acting Commissioner at the Department of Education and Early Development. I will be doing that until 5 o'clock on the February 2nd. The next morning, Commissioner Mike Hanley will be on staff with us and begin his duties as Commissioner of Education. At that time, we'll make sure he does have an opportunity to get up here as soon as possible, interact with the committee members so that you get to know Commissioner Hanley. I'd like to start by just giving you a little background about who I am so that you know the experience I bring to the table when I'm sharing information with you besides just my current role. So real briefly, I've been an educator in Alaska since 1986. I began my career in the Lower Yukon School District as a school teacher at the high school and K-12 level doing technology work. And I taught in the Lower Yukon School District in the village of Hooper Bay. In 1990, I became a teacher at Juno Douglas High School here in Juno, where I worked for 7 years. I was a principal in the Juno School District at one of the two middle schools for 6 years prior to beginning work at the Department of Education in 2003, where I worked for a little over 5 years as the Director of Assessment and Accountability. It was through that experience, actually, I had my first opportunity to interact with Representative Dick when he was a member of a science standards committee that my group oversaw. For the last 2.5 years, approximately, I've served as deputy commissioner at the department until December 6th, when I became acting commissioner for the transition. So that gives you a little background about myself. In terms of my presentation today, I looked at the questions and thought about the kinds of things that I think the committee was looking for in those questions. We did some follow-up, and I've divided my presentation into three components. The first part, I'm going to talk about the overarching goals and mission of the department, as well as the structure of the department. And at that time, because I think our budget document does a nice job of helping you see the structure also, I'm going to do a overview of the a couple of pages in our budget document. What I can do is, if there's more questions about the budget at the end of the presentation, come back to those. But so the first part of the presentation, hopefully you'll really have a good understanding of the structure of our department and its connection to our budget. When I conclude that component, I'll go ahead and ask questions so you don't have to, or answer questions so you don't have to save those till the very end of the total presentation. The second part of the presentation, I'd like to focus on that history of Alaska's education. There were some questions that go back to the transfer from BIA to our current operations, and there are several steps in between. And so I'm going to try to draw a picture. With that, I do have a handout that you received, and I have some additional points that will augment that handout. And then again, I'll take questions after that. The final and third part of the presentation, which may either come today or I'll be back before you again Wednesday, we'll look at the characteristics of school districts in Alaska and schools in Alaska, hopefully building an understanding of the difference between our largest districts, our rural districts that are on road system, as well as our rural districts, often referred to as bush districts, that are off the road system, and draw some pictures of those in terms of their characteristics, as well as address issues, challenges, and opportunities that we see in the coming years with education. So, Chair Dick, if that sounds reasonable, I'll go ahead and begin the presentation.
Very good, yeah, most reasonable.
Okay. The handouts for the first part of the presentation that I'll use is one that's titled the House Education Committee Department of Education Early Development Overview, and it has a question on what's the overarching educational philosophy of EED, which is Education and Early Development. There's also an organization chart that we provided you that gives you a high-level view of our structure in terms of the commissioner, deputy, and directors. And then there is the operating FY 2012 operating capital budget. And I'm going to only be referring to the first couple of pages of that document at this time for the structure. So those are the three documents you may want to have in front of you. In terms of the department's mission, we gathered a large number of citizens together a couple of years ago and looked at the scope of what the department's role is, as well as what people, stakeholders, feel that the department ought to be doing. And through that process, we developed a mission statement that you'll see written on here on this sheet of paper. In addition, we took this mission statement to the State Board of Education that approved the mission statement of the department. And I am going to read the mission statement because it's fairly short, and I'd like to make sure it's read into the record. Alaska's education system fosters creativity and curiosity, embraces diversity. Alaska's students have the skills and knowledge to contribute to local, state, national, and global communities by understanding the past and present, and they are prepared to create the future. Again, when this mission statement was created by the group, I actually sat in by the group that put the words to the paper, and they spent a considerable amount of time on each and every word. For example, the end statement, preparing Prepared to Create the Future was a very in-depth discussion of them trying to think about what districts should do, what schools should do, and what the department needs to help those districts and schools do in terms of our regulatory work, is to make sure students are prepared for those types of things in their future. I also wanted to read into the record, because I think this is, to me, crystal clear also in its statutory language. It's from 1403-105, State Education Policy, and it's been in our statute for some time. It is the policy of the state that the purpose of education is to help ensure that all students will succeed in their education and work, shape worthwhile and satisfying lives for themselves, and exemplify the best values of society, and be effective in improving the character and quality of the world about them. And I think you see those, that mission statement and that educational policy come alive in our department through the work that we do. Even when we're administering federal programs, we try to make sure that we're paying attention to what Alaskans want when we're putting those programs into place. There are always certain requirements in implementing federal programs, but we can always make sure we're doing our best to make sure they fit Alaska as we implement those things. I also think that when you look at our full department, and many of these statements talk about the future, we have components of our department that go beyond K-12 in terms of, especially with libraries, archives, and museums. And so the whole thought about lifelong learning and preserving Alaska's history is very relevant to the overall mission of our complete department. I next want to draw your attention to the organizational chart, because I think this will begin defining the sections of our department so that you can see the pieces and how they fit the whole picture. And I'm going to work, I'll start at the top, of course, Commissioner Hanley. Again, I mentioned on February 3rd, he will be on staff with us here at the department as he's completing his current duties as of February 1 in the role he currently holds in a school district. I serve as the deputy commissioner, and then in terms of the next section on here, I want to talk about the division directors, but I'm going to begin on the right side and work myself to the left side of the sheet of paper. The first division I want to mention is Mount Edgecombe High School, which is a high school in Sitka, Alaska. It's a boarding school, and it is a state school. So I have to say that is the one school we are absolutely directly responsible for in terms of what happens there. Our director there, who is often referred to as a superintendent, but he is a division director in the state system, is Randy Hawk. Randy Hawk has approximately 53 staff. That includes the maintenance staff, the teaching staff that are there. And again, some of these numbers will be also highlighted when I walk you into our budget document, so you'll be able to see them there. There are approximately 400 students at Mount Edgecombe. As of today, I don't know exactly the number, but we're always shooting to have 400 students that are there for the full year. So we often have a few more in the fall, but try to make sure that at semester two and through semester two, we do have students. And if we lose students for one reason or another, we do bring in students off our wait list at semester. So that's our first division I wanted to touch on. Since Randy Hawk is a superintendent, he is not here in the audience, and I cannot introduce him, but should he be here in Juneau at some point, we would be able to get him before you. The next division that I want to mention is the Division of Administrative Services. The director is in the audience, I believe. Anna Kim, could you stand up so they know you? Thank you. Anna has a staff of 16, but it is a workhorse of a department because it makes sure everything from our bills are paid to our budget presentations are prepared and ready to be before you. She will, I know some of you are also members of the subcommittee for House Finance that will be looking at our budget, and you will become very knowledgeable about Anna Kim's work and the work of our budget. This is also where our IT section is, which supports all of our department, including some technical support for Mount Edgecombe, as well as quite a great deal of support for two of the commissions that fall under our department that I'll also be speaking about in this presentation. The next division that I'd like to address is libraries, archives, and museums. The director is Linda Thibodeau, who is also in the audience. Could you stand? Linda Thibodeau has approximately 67 staff. In terms of the physical facility of where you will find her, if you walk through the state office building, the eighth floor is the state library. The archive is just outside down the street in terms of the main headquarters. It's a building that has had many challenges in the last few years in terms of some things that we've had to worry about in terms of leakage and things like that. And then the State Museum has a facility a couple of blocks from there, as well as we have a facility in Sitka, the Sheldon Jackson Museum there. The next division that I'd like to mention is the School Finance and Facilities. The director of this division is Elizabeth Noodleman, and also I believe she's here. Elizabeth has a staff of approximately 13. The major component of our budget in terms of the state foundation, which is the largest amount of the general fund dollars that come to our department, which we move those dollars out to school districts, run through this division. So they're responsible for a significant amount of the dollars, making sure those dollars go to the districts, that the districts' budgets are reviewed at the department. In addition, the facilities component is work that is done around major maintenance, the debt reimbursement, and those types of things around capital projects. So that is the division where those pieces occur. The next division, which is our fifth division, is called Teaching and Learning Support. It is the largest division, and it's the core of our work with K-12 in terms of teaching and learning and those kinds of supports. I do not believe Cindy Curran was able to be with us unless she's... No. So Cindy Curran is the director. However, you will have opportunities to interact with Cindy Curran. I believe she's on your schedule for Friday. And we'll be visiting with you about a working group that we've had around graduation success, along with one of our other, not a division director, but another director in our department, which I'll be mentioning in a few moments. I want to spend a little bit of time on teaching and learning support because of its significance, and make sure you're aware of the programs that are in that area, because it may raise questions throughout the session that you want to learn more about, and I think that just an overview of that division itself would be helpful. When we speak of the various federal programs at the department, one of the largest laws that we work to implement from the federal level and then have to develop plans, how is our state going to approach that, is something called the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, first enacted in 1965, amended several times, most recently amended in 2001 by a law called No Child Left Behind. So oftentimes you will hear educators refer to this as ESEA reauthorized by NCLB. But the core law is ESEA, Elementary Secondary Education Act. There are lots of programs that fall within this, but I'm just going to highlight a couple that are rather significant in terms of the work behind that law. And some of the components, like the assessment system, are things that we do to accomplish things in the federal law, but we also do to accomplish things that are clearly outlined in state statute in terms of our testing program. It's not just a federal testing program. It's very clearly in our state statutes as well. So under the Elementary Secondary Education Act, one of the largest components is Title I, which is education for disadvantaged students, and it's a focus on economically disadvantaged. And that's the core of that, the purpose behind that law was to level the playing field in terms of performance of students. So you'll hear educators talk about there are Title I schools and there are non-Title I schools. Title I schools are those schools that meet the appropriate criteria to have enough students in them that they can deliver services that are funded through Title I, or the law that support students who are economically disadvantaged. Our accountability system in the state, though, applies to all schools because the intent of that law is to level the playing field. So we make sure how we rate a Title I school is the same way we would rate a non-Title I school. And actually, that was clarified and tightened up in the No Child Left Behind law that reauthorized ESEA. Also under this law are Title III, which is about English language acquisition and supporting students in learning to be proficient speakers of the English language. There are components of this law that include education for homeless students so that they make sure that they're not having their learning disrupted. Education for migrant students to support them in their learning as well. Some other major parts of teaching and learning support include special education and preschool, which special education has some clear pieces that are very defined in federal law, but there's also some funding components that the state has that this group also makes sure districts are implementing correctly, particularly around students who are severely cognitively disabled, and there's some additional funding through the state formula with that. Also, this is where our preschool group is supervised. Things around a preschool pilot we've had in the past, work with Head Start and our involvement with the Head Start programs. We also have teacher certification and teacher quality. Teacher certification is primarily a state function of making sure teachers hold appropriate certification. This is particularly an area where there often are lots of questions, lots of concerns, and Cindy Curran, the director of Teaching and Learning Support, prior to serving as director, was the administrator of this program. She's an absolute expert in this area, and I know in conversations that I've had with Representative Seaton, there potentially be some questions around this area that he or other members may have, and she'll be able to present at any point to clarify statutory rules, regulatory rules, the kinds of directions we're taking in the future. The group also deals with teacher quality and how can we improve the performance of teaching in our state, and there has actually been a work group around teacher quality that she has been facilitating, and they've done quite a bit of work, and they're bringing regulations before the board, and at some point I think it may be useful for the committee to receive a presentation focused on certification and as well as teacher quality. Child Nutrition Services falls under TLS. Career Technical Education and the Alaska Career Ready Work falls under Teaching and Learning Support, TLS. Charter Schools, Correspondence, Health, Safety. Also, I mentioned earlier the assessment and accountability system. That's been such a significant component of this group that there is a director that we have, not a division director, but a director within the division. His name is Eric McCormick, who is my understanding he will probably be before you also on Friday because he's been involved with the graduation work group. And then another group that I want to mention, it's called the State System of Support. It is actually designed primarily to support not only, well, two things, underperforming school districts so that we can improve student achievement. The other work that they do based on some staff that the legislature approved for us to hire last year is some broader work around the content areas of math, science, and literacy. That is a group primarily state-funded. Out of this 94 staff in teaching and learning support, the vast majority of them are implementing federal programs. So when you have 94 staff there, outside of the state system of support and preschool, a few state programs within there, the vast majority of these are making sure those federal programs are implemented correctly based on not only federal law, but then any state plans that give those laws our Alaska focus. I want to jump down from there on the org chart to the three, there's three groups mentioned at the bottom that are They are commissions under our structure that we have varying degrees of involvement with. The first one is Professional Teaching Practices Commission. The executive director of that commission is Patricia Truman. Patricia Truman has a staff of two. One is herself, the other is her support staff. And that commission makes sure that Alaska's professional teaching, the staff, the principals are following the state ethics guidelines, and they do investigations and those types of things as they warrant. There is a commission that oversees that body, but they are under our budget structure. We also do some support for them around finance, travel, some of the administrative things. The Alaska State Council of the Arts, the executive director of that group is Charlotte Fox. Charlotte Fox, including herself, has a staff of six. Both of those groups are housed in Anchorage. Charlotte Fox oversees, in terms of direct interaction with schools, the artists in the school program, but then there are several other components of the Arts Council that Charlotte Fox oversees as well, that are not directly connected to K-12 schools. And then the last section is, or the last commission is the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education. Diane Behrens is the executive director of that group. Diane is before the legislature many times on multiple topics around scholarship issues, so you will, if you don't know Diane, you will probably have a chance to get to know Diane. The core of the Alaska Commission of Post-Secondary Education is housed here in Juneau, and I don't know if I mentioned she has, including herself, approximately a staff of 97. We do less support for them in terms of issues around IT, but we work with them through our admin services as well, so they are connected in that way. What I'd like to do now is refer to the budget document, and what I'm going to walk you into is a couple of pictures around how funding works in the department and where those dollars go. Then I'm going to walk you into the components of our budget, and what I'll do is outline what divisions those components fall under, because I think that'll help draw the picture of how these divisions each show up in our budget. I'm only going to refer at this point to the first two pages of the budget document. There is more detail behind the budget document. I can come back and address that. I could also come back, if we have time on Wednesday, I could go into those details. But some of you will be getting a heavy dose of this in the finance subcommittee over education. So I don't want to be duplicative, but I think there's some information here that can really help you walk and see into and see our structure of the budget. So if I could refer to the first page, behind the title page, I want to just look at a couple of pie charts that are there. The first one I want to refer to is the very first on the upper left-hand side of the page, the first pie chart. And what this does is it shows you of the general fund operating budget that comes into the department, the percent that's agency funding versus formula funding. And toward the end of this component of the presentation, I'll highlight what those formula-funded parts of the program are. So you'll see that 5% is agency operations, 95% is formula programs. The next graph is focused, or the next pie chart to the right of that, is focused just on agency operations. And you'll see that 73% of the agency is operated on federal funds and 19% on general funds, 8% on other funds. And so that gives you a picture of the agency operations itself. At this point, I want to turn to page 2 of the document. If you're visual like I am, you might want to draw lines at points where I tell you here, because what I'm going to try to do is I'm going to go down to the lower part of this chart on page 2 under agency operations, and I'm going to connect each of those components to the divisions they belong to that I walked through on the organizational chart. The first one line is executive administration, and that is exactly what it is. It doesn't belong to a division. We're over the department, and so it's the executive administration. So if you are like I did with my packet, I drew a line underneath that to distinguish that one sits by itself. The next two, administrative services and information services, those two line components connect to administrative services. Again, I mentioned the director of that section is Anna Kim. If you draw a line right under information services, you'll see the next section is school finance and facilities. It's a single line. It has the staff, by the way, in the gray column to the right. And that's the group that Elizabeth Nudelman is the director over. I think the next will begin again to show how, in terms of our K-12 support, the core of our department is teaching and learning support. So the next six line items, student and school achievement, statewide system of support, statewide mentoring program, teacher certification, child nutrition, early learning coordination. I drew a line right under early learning coordination. All those things, those six groupings are part of the Division of Teaching and Learning Support, which Cindy Curran is the director of that division. You'll see under student and school achievement, there are 70 staff there. And you can see that the budget is the largest in terms of our agency within that section. That's the core of all the federal programs that I was speaking of in terms of everything from NCLB, special education, and those kinds of things fit within there. So they are primarily, that group of 70 people are primarily administering federal programs and federal funds. Right under that group, there is a single line. This is Professional Teaching Practices Commission, it indicates there's the two staff. That's the group that Pat Truman is responsible for, and she's an executive director under the structure of our department. The next is a single line for another, the Arts Council, the Alaska State Council on the Arts. Again, you can see that she has six staff. That includes Charlotte Fox, the executive director. The next component, actually, it fits two components because the state facilities maintenance people, as well as Mount Edgecombe Boarding School, those go together at Mount Edgecombe. So that has two lines with that component. That's the group that I indicated that Randy Hawk is our division director, also referred to as the superintendent of Mount Edgecombe High School. State facilities rent is the next component. It doesn't have a staff, and it is sort of like the executive administration. It's our overall department. It's the rent for facilities that we utilize. The next three lines, library operations, archives, and museum operations, is the library, archives, and museums. And again, Linda Thibodeau is in the audience, and she's the division director over that group. And then the last three items all fall under the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education. So those last three are with the commission that Diane Behrens is the executive director over. So that is our agency operations, and that, I think, draws a picture of how those budget components can back right into the org chart so you can see who is connected to each of those line items on there. And of course, each one of those, especially if you look at student and school administration, has many, many components within it that division is responsible for.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question. Thank you. Les, I remember when it's got the petitions, permanent or full-time people, and then part-time. I can't remember what NP was.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, the NP is not non-perm staff. And so they're brought on for a temporary purpose or perhaps a project. We also have to get approval to bring those people on. But oftentimes you'll see that for perhaps a grant program. We have a grant under the Library, Archives, and Museums right now, a very large grant called the Broadband grant. And so we're going to bring on some non-perm staff just for the period of time of that grant. When the grant goes away, then those non-perm staff also go away.
Follow-up. So that's you contract out for those people?
We may contract out, or we may actually hire people on staff, but they come on knowing their position would end, and they'll either they will go away at the conclusion, or they might transfer to another opening that has occurred within the state in our agency or another agency at the conclusion of that non-perm position.
One more follow-up. The three people that we added last year, are they in the governor's budget again this year?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, those three are in the budget there, and I can tell you where they're at. If you look under that section I mentioned as the state system of support, that are TLS, and then there's a line there called state system of support. Those three are three of the seven positions that are indicated there.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. The last component that I'd like to walk through in terms of our structure is have you walk back up and just look at the formula programs. Again, this isn't primarily a budget presentation, but the questions included having some familiarity with our budget structure. And since the largest component of our funding that is general funds that comes into the department is in formula programs, I think it's important we just look at the various formula programs that exist. So you'll see the largest one, the foundation program, is first under the formula programs. This is the dollars that is based first off the BSA, the base student allocation to the school districts. You also see other formula programs that fall under here that include the boarding home grants, youth in detention, special schools, pupil transportation, the Alaska Challenge Youth Academy. The next one I'm not even going to mention, it's no longer funded, but remains there, but you can see it's zeroed out. And then the school debt reimbursement is the final program. And during the finance committees, we'll have the people who are experts in those various areas, as well as Anna Kim, presenting on the details behind those. But I could, at this point, I think I want to stop and just see if there are questions from the committee on any of these items that I can answer. If there's something that you ask that we think we should go ahead and get answered right now, and I have one of the directors who's an expert in the audience, I'll ask them to come up if that's appropriate. Thank you.
Question? Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The special schools, since it doesn't include the Challenge Academy or Edgecombe, what are the special schools?
Under special schools, it includes CESA, which is a special education service agency. They are a formula program, and they serve special needs in particular districts around school psychology services, those kinds of things that many of our districts simply wouldn't bring on full-time positions just for that. They also serve some special schools that are housed in Anchorage. At the Alaska Psychiatric Hospital, there's a Providence Heights school that serves students who are there short-term as well as long-term. The Alaska School for the Deaf, which is physically in Anchorage, but students from across the state will attend there. And then there'll be other students that may have special needs that might be at one of these schools or at some other facility and temporarily in foster care or in a group home, and these dollars support education in those instances as well.
Follow up?
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So when we're talking about foster care, is that all foster care across the state, or are there certain segments that are funded separately than through the school district?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, it's my understanding that these dollars are just in instances where a student would have some level of special needs that can't be delivered in their home school where they're at, and they're put in another setting, and this is just addressing their educational needs, not other issues, not the funding around the foster care, but just their educational needs in those instances.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Faye?
Yes, through the chair. Under the line here for school performance incentive programs, you said this was not funded. Why did they decide to not fund it?
Through the chair, Representative Feige, that was a program that had a sunset. It was funded by the legislature approximately, I'm having to guess, about 4 or 5 years ago. It was to fund a program that would offer basically financial rewards to all people who work in a school where there was a growth in student achievement. It was something that we developed at the department, and we sought funding from the legislature to be able to implement the program, but the program did have a sunset on it, and the program was not renewed by the legislature, nor was it requested by the department. However, we still continue to do the calculations behind that growth model, but we do not fund the incentives anymore.
Representative Feige.
Yeah, through the chair, I understand it. It sunsetted. Did it work? And is it something that's worth reauthorizing?
Through the chair, Representative Feige, we could get into the details in terms of how it worked. It was actually rather controversial. Some educators did not like it and felt that it didn't work in terms of what they perceived. We felt that at the department it did what it intended, which was to reward schools that grew significantly in achievement or had high achievement and maintained that achievement. In terms of future direction with the program, we'll be making sure Commissioner Hanley's aware of the kinds of things that we've done around this work, but I wouldn't suggest where we would be going at this point, other than I can tell you that there is significant national conversation around how do we look at how schools are doing and not just looking at status performance, but are students growing in their student achievement? And are there ways that we can recognize schools for that? So the calculations we do behind the scene to figure out is this school growing in terms of students' achievement, I think is very valuable information that we want to maintain and continue to look at. Whether we reward performance based on it, I think is a broader policy question that we would have to have an in-depth conversation over.
Thank you. Representative Kawasaki, you had a question?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Commissioner. I had a question on the pilot pre-K program. It's probably 2 years in now. I was just wondering if you could give us sort of an update, just a general update today.
Yes, through the chair, Mr. Kawasaki, the program actually was put forward in the governor's budget in the past as a one-time increment, and those dollars are still in our budget, but we put them into the base of our budget, and they are under the early learning coordination. We have carefully studied the program in terms of its impacts on year one. We're in year two right now, and we've looked at each of the sites that were funded, the students' performance in those sites, and I can generally speak to that report, but I think if the committee wants to go into detail about that, we would want to make sure the Teaching and Learning Support Director comes and we have a full report. We'd provide you in advance for background reading. Generally, though, what I can say is we have some programs on there that showed some very promising signs. I think there are some areas that were not only promising but also efficient delivery. And I think in terms of how we would use those dollars in the future, we wouldn't be just looking at where did it work well, but where did it work well in the most efficient manner so that we can get the maximum utilization out of those dollars as we fund various programs. What we did is we ran a competition, asked districts to propose programs. We weren't necessarily piloting early childhood because there's lots of advocacy around that in various ways. What we were piloting is what approaches in Alaska make sense. And so different districts took different approaches with that, and some of them clearly were very promising. And I can think of reading the report there in the Yukon-Koyukuk School District, which is mostly a rural school district. They have a large correspondence school within them as well, a statewide correspondence, but they're mostly a rural school district outside of Fairbanks. They had a couple of different styles in terms of programs they put in place. One offered a great deal of coordination between their current Head Start so that the transitions were smoother into the K-12, and we really made sure there was consistency for that student performance. And there was some in terms of their pre- and post-assessment data on student knowledge that they gained over the time and with that program was very, very promising. So that's a general report, but I think we really enjoy going into more depth and making sure you had some pre-reading to that we could walk through the various performance levels.
Representative Seaton.
Yeah, and just following up on this, does the department plan to carry this at least through third grade? I mean, following those students, tracking those that participated, those did not, so that we find out whether there's short-term gains or those gains are maintained throughout the system?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, absolutely. What we did is every student who participated in that program, they had to register and make sure they had the state student ID, which is what is the tool we use to track students for lots of reasons, as performance as well as funding, and we will be able to analyze those results. And the kinds of assessments they'll see is we do an entry assessment into our system, developmental profile that you take as either a kindergartner or a first grader whenever you first arrive, and then obviously the third grade assessments when we start our standards-based assessments. So absolutely, and that's a little bit of the detail about how we'll look at that.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Up here, we're under special schools where we had CESA. Is that the same thing as CERC, or is CERC something else?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, it is something different. CESA is a special education service agency. It's, again, it's a formula-funded program under our statutes, and they are primarily designed to serve districts around issues of special education where there's real specialized needs. CERC is the Southeast Regional Resource Center, which is separate. It's a service agency that districts will contract with. They sometimes hold contracts from the department. They actually go out and bid on different requests for proposals to run various projects, including some from the department. And they serve districts in terms of their business needs, special education services, all those types of things. But that's on a contract service with that district. So the district is in a business relationship with CERC when they work with them, CERC, again, being Southeast Regional Resource Center.
Where does CERC fit in this, or, you know?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, they're actually not a part of our agency. They're really an independent business, a nonprofit business, and so they, again, we sometimes contract with them, but they're not a component of our agency. They're just like if they do business with us, many times it's because they bid just like any private business could bid on an award we might have out or a project we have out. With the school districts, they have the right to work with them, again, for various needs. But again, it's a contractual relationship between that district and that organization, and they're not part of our structure.
Okay. And the reason I was asking is because I can remember when we were working on the funding of how we were going to get some of the unfunded liability worked up, because they were, like some communities, were using the same process as the public employees. And so that's where I was confused, because I was thinking that we were involved with them, but I guess not.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I can't speak to the details. However, I can speak to the fact that the employees in their agency are part of the state retirement system. But to give you a historical view of that and reasons, I'd have to dig deeper into that.
Thank you.
Very good, but I don't know anybody else, but I need a brief at ease. Come to order, if maybe you could continue with the next portion of that, and then we will, Department of Education needs to, has another meeting at 9:30, and at that time, perhaps Representative Feige can give his presentation from last week, and I bet that will wrap us up for the day. So if you wouldn't mind to continue.
Absolutely. Again, for the record, Les Morris, the current acting commissioner at Education and Early Development. The next component of the presentation actually was incredibly fascinating, not only to prepare, but in part because I was asked to look at some of the history of Alaska education and draw a picture of Alaska education in terms of structural changes. Well, my major was history, so I couldn't do this lightly. I had to actually do a lot of research, and thank goodness within our own department is the Library, Archives, and Museums. They have incredible researchers, and I utilized their services last week to verify what I was finding and offer some a little bit more detail. These things I generally knew, but I could not I wouldn't have been able to speak specifically about, but because of the love I have for history, thank you for submitting those questions. I enjoyed this. I provided you a document that I'm going to use for this component of the presentation, actually two documents. One is titled The Historical Overview of Education in Alaska. It has two components to it, a front and back, or stapled. I don't know how yours is prepared. One looks at the organization of schools and issues around local control, and the second page of that looks at school accountability. There's also a document in your packet that, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it, but I'm going to point out that you can see that the turnover from BIA schools was over an incredibly long period of time, because we provided you a document that lists community where there was a school and the year it was either turned over to Alaska, because you'll see that it was either turned over to potentially the territory of Alaska, because the first year goes back to 1938, clear through to 1985, obviously during statehood. Let me start with the first document, the historical overview. I'm not going to go over each one of these pieces. You may find them interesting, though, reading, if you like to look at the long-term history. And actually, you can go back farther than this, but we're not going to go into the Russian period of Alaska history. But there was interesting reading I did around that as well. I'm going to start with the third item down, which is the early 1900s, because I think it's important to start seeing when we began building the dual system of education in Alaska, where there were rural schools treated in one way, and then schools within towns, communities, cities treated in another way. And it was, I don't have a specific date, but in the early 1900s, Congress granted authority to individual communities that organized or incorporated to establish their own schools and to maintain them through taxation, which is a system, obviously, that continues today in our cities and boroughs in the state of Alaska. After that, so obviously that first piece happened between 1900 and 1904. 1905, the Nelson Act was passed, and this is established when schools were established outside of incorporated towns, and that the governor of Alaska was actually named the ex officio superintendent. So the territorial governor actually for a period of time served the role as the superintendent of schools for the unorganized areas, or the, I should say, areas that were not in incorporated towns in Alaska. And really that begins that dual system of operation of schools in Alaska. The next piece I want to point out is a couple of bullets down from that, or they're not bulleted, but under the section right under the 1931 part, the next section speaks to the passage of the Johnson-O'Malley Act. And it was at this point that that act really outlined how schools, and I use the word in here, could be transferred from federal-operated BIA schools to the territory of Alaska. And I really ought to have said it's that act, instead of transfer, is that act set up the ability for the Secretary of Interior to establish contracts with people within the state to operate those schools. So it's less of the way the law actually reads is less about transfer. For all intents and purposes, that's what it did, but it was really contracting for services to be more with either within the state or within locally local control. Throughout all of this, there's a continual ongoing movement, even within BIA schools, when schools stayed BIA schools, for people in local communities to gain more control, not just in Alaska, but all across the country where BIA schools existed. The next piece that I want to point out is under 1965. And at this point, we have statehood. We have the Alaska State Department of Education, is what it was referred to at that time. And this is the year they established what was called state-operated schools, SOS. It was a division within the department. I even found the organizational chart for it that existed at that time, if you want that much detail. But it was a fairly extensive division in terms of working with support for personnel hiring, for curriculum development. It basically was the full function of those districts under state-operated schools. Again, that was established in 1965. We could not find a great deal of support. However, we found reference to a governor's committee being established to look at the merger of BIA to state schools, but couldn't find any records of any work that they had done. Perhaps they did not do any work, because what came about a number of years later is the tension significantly increased, and there was a pretty significant demand based on the record that I read put on the legislature to change that system. And so the next piece I want to refer to is under 1975, the state-operated schools was abolished, so that division in the department went away, and there was a separate system set up called the Rural Education Attendance Areas, or REAAs, that still exists today. There was a transition built in, and this I don't have documented on here, so listen carefully, because I was asked about this, but I got this documentation after I put this together. This organization had an incredibly brief history. It was called the Unorganized Borough School District. The Unorganized Borough School District provided for the administration of the rural schools after the abolishment of the state-operated schools and until school boards were established under the REAAs. So it really had a window of July 1, 1975 to June 30, 1976, because as the REAAs were established with their own boards, then the Unorganized Borough School District went away. But it was because SOS was, the state system support was abolished, but the REAAs had to get organized. There had to be something in that period of time. The one other thing that I think is important to mention here is in 74, a lawsuit, the Molly Hooch case, was filed. If you've not heard about that, it really focuses on secondary education, and you'll see the last reference on this page is 1976, mentions that the governor signed a consent decree which established high school programs in every community based on certain enrollment criteria and based on that community wanting that. Those were pieces around that decree. So that gives you a little historical background. Again, for reference, I gave you that chart of all the communities where BIA schools existed in the year that we have documentation that went to either the territory or the state of Alaska. And again, you'll see that some of that is very recent history. It precedes my beginning of my education career in Alaska by only 1 year, where there were several schools turned over in 1985. I think the next piece, which is on the second page of the historical overview that I provided, is the school accountability, which began to really take shape in 1991. And I'm just going to highlight a few things on this page. I'm not going to walk through each and every piece. In 1992, the State Board of Education passed regulations for the first time that said every district had to provide students a working knowledge in several areas: English, mathematics, science, geography, history, and skills for healthy living, government, citizenship, fine arts, technology, and world languages. Again, as a regulation, later standards were developed in these areas, but at that point it was saying that students needed a working knowledge in those areas. In 1995 and 1996, over that two-year period, the State Board adopted content standards for each of those areas. Those content standards were very broad. They weren't by grade level, but they said, here's what a student should have. If they have working knowledge in these areas, this is what it would look like. Those standards for many of those areas are still on the books today, except in areas of mathematics, science, reading, and writing, where we have further defined them in much more detail at the grade level so that it could support instruction as well as an assessment program. In 2000 is the year the State Board began looking at more detailed content standards in those areas, so they first did that in that year. Later that year, we gave assessments to students in grades 3, 6, and 8 based on those standards for the first time in Alaska. So you can see our testing history related to our own content standards is really quite recent. Doesn't mean we didn't test prior to that. We were just using nationally normed reference tests and not our own what's called criteria reference tests. Means the criteria was our standards. 2004 was the first year students were held accountable on the high school graduation qualifying exam. That law was passed in 97, but 2004 is the first year students were held accountable to that exam. And in 2005 is the year that we developed, and actually we the State Board adopted grade level expectations. So those content standards, you see, they went from large general standards to standards that said by third grade, by sixth grade, by eighth grade, this is what you need to know, to by third, fourth, fifth, and each grade level, this is what you need to know. Mm-hmm. By the way, the department, it's been 10 years, standards ought to be looked at every now and then, and the department has just launched a process that we're beginning to re-examine those standards. And we started that process by asking university people and industry people to come to the table and say, look at our current standards. Is this the right level? What does it take to make sure they're ready to enter the university in credit-bearing courses and go into industry? So that process has begun, and it will be a few more meetings, and we intend to do a full report to our State Board of Education at their March meeting about where we think we need to go in the next year or so with that process. So that was a little bit less information than my first component, but the goal here was to, one, give a brief history so you could see that movement from the schools that we have to our current structure. Note that we still do have, we have borough school districts, we have REAAs that still exist, and we have districts in first-class cities. At the last component of my presentation where I draw images or a little bit more information about each of those different types of areas and provide some characteristics, I think will also help flesh those things out. But this was the part two of my presentation. Again, I think it would be helpful for the committee if I stop and see if there are any questions.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Since you brought it up in the year 2000, benchmark assessments given to third, sixth, and eighth, I was just curious if there's benchmark assessments given to kindergartners that are administered by the state, or maybe there's some school districts you know of that do that.
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, we have a standardized assessment that is given when students enter the school system that is required to be given if they come in kindergarten, if not, then in their first grade. It's called the developmental profile. And what it looks at is primarily readiness skills. Is the student, can this student pick up a book, hold it the right way, and begin turning the pages in the right direction to show that they're ready to begin learning how to read? It goes over lots of different components like that, but that's the only statewide assessment. Now, that's not to say that districts don't give assessments. Many districts give assessments that provide teachers yet more detailed information to focus learning. There's a number of common ones that they do give. I think it's actually quite rare that they don't give more assessment than that at the local level.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page one down here in 76, Governor signed the consent decree for Molly Hooch, and then it says that the agreement is at a minimum minimum 8 students. And I'm curious as how that melds with, or is that in conflict with our current budgeting formula that has schools as sites with 10 or more students?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, again, that the way that that was written was 8 students who are in elementary and 1 or more students at secondary. So, in fact, this consent decree was based on, could be based on 9 students. And again, if the community wanted that, the statute now is a community must have at least 10 students. That comes after this and takes precedence over this. But this was established at that time to begin the development of those schools when they fit that criteria. So what you point out is important to note that there are changes that have been made in statute since then in terms of the funding formula for those schools.
Thank you.
We have bullets in terms of time here, but as I've watched education change over the years, I can remember, and I did watch school district, the first in service, the superintendent Zulu had everybody up in Medford cutting fish because he felt like all the teachers needed to be in touch with the you know, with the villages and how people's lifestyle. And at some point, I'd like to just take a look at maybe the transition in education on that level, mm-hmm. is how people's attitude towards relation to community. I think during the BIA days, it was more of an imposition of, you know, this is what this is how school is in the lower 48, and this is how it'll be here. Where there really has been a sensitivity in a lot of the rural areas is trying to relate to communities and all. So sometime I'd like to visit that with the committee, and because in order for us to know where we're heading, we certainly need to know where we're coming from. And there have been some wonderful things that have taken place in the past, and there's been times when people have had blinders on. So I think we all ought to put our heads in that direction and just see how we can just compare where we've been and where we're going.
Chair Dick, if I could respond just a little bit and to that, because it's the background reading I did in preparation does address many of those things. And I think if I can shed light on anything in terms of the academic background I have related to that from the recent reading, but also my own experiences more recently. The one reason I think it's important to look at that accountability component and that history from 1991 on is I think it may have had an impact on what you just mentioned. But if you go farther back than that and look at all the tension with the BIA schools, I mentioned at one point that even as the BIA schools operated, there were certain pressures on BIA to pay attention more closely to the local community. There was even a law in the 1970s that passed at the federal level that dealt with BIA schools all across the country. But a lot of those pressures were significant in Alaska, of trying to have the curriculums of the schools reflect those local areas. And this is not, it's not just true in Alaska, but it was true with BIA schools across the country. And there was always a tension in any of the reading that you might do around that history between local control and the curriculum of those BIA schools. It was clear that the BIA schools came in with a curriculum designed for the average child across this country, and that the pressures around that. You'll even hear people who have personal stories in Alaska about what speaking their own language, that's their own native language or their first language, and whether they could or could not do that. And this is such a recent history that you can find contemporary adults who've had those experiences. I worked with many and still do, especially in the years that I taught in rural Alaska. Oftentimes that were the parents or maybe even oldest siblings of some of the children that I taught in the 1980s. So that tension continues. And then I think we hear a lot about it in the more recent history, the last 20 years, because of the movement to have content standards taught. And I think there, in my view, is a misperception that because we ask kids to know math, we're saying that is more important than understanding your local culture. And I think, if I might add my view, is that that's a leadership problem. Because there is no reason that when you learn to read well or write well, you can't learn to read well and write well about your own local geography, your own local customs, and your own local culture. There is no reason those things cannot be integrated in very thoughtful ways. And there's one person that I did not mention that's a part of our department that serves, she's a program coordinator, but we often refer to her as a director, but it's a director of rural education. One of the tasks that I've given her name is Phyllis Carlson, and it may be worth having her here at some point, but Phyllis Carlson is tasked with taking our cultural standards, which we have cultural standards for students and what they ought to know if they're going to be paying attention to the culture that exists around them in their school and their community. And we're working toward building good tools, and some already exist, so we're just identifying where they're at and bringing them back to the surface, that help teachers think about that very point when they're going in and teaching. So when I'm teaching this science lesson, or when I'm teaching this writing lesson, how can I use the culture, the community, the geography? And this is not just true in rural Alaska. Frankly, I don't think if you don't know your students, how can you possibly teach them? I think it's true just down the street at any school here in Juneau as well. So I think it's an important point, and there is this tension that existed, and I think it has been increased because of No Child Left Behind, but I, again, still believe that's a leadership problem more so than it is a problem any law has placed on our schools.
Two things. One, if you give me, I had received a note earlier that Representative Sisson is online with us, and Representative Sisson, if you want to participate in the questions at all, I think the technology exists for that, so please feel free to get our attention. Yes, please go ahead, Representative Sisson.
I'm thank you so very much. I'm hoping you can hear me. Very brief presentation and for me, coming in into that particular dentistry. But one of the things that my rural students are doing is having much more contact by a video telecom. So I'm wondering if it's possible somewhere during this next session for this committee to talk to some of the rural communities as well as the more urban communities about some of these issues, to hear from them as well.
Yeah, Representative Sisson, it was a little bit hard to hear. Maybe if you backed off from the microphone a little bit, we got most of that, but not all of that. That would help. Could you maybe give us a concise summary of that that statement again?
I'm wondering if we can hear students throughout Alaska at as well as maybe the educators as well. I'm watching you on the TV on the
computer. Okay. I'm still having a hard time to understand the.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead, Representative Seaton.
Mr. Chairman, I think Representative Sisson was asking if in the future you could schedule a meeting with some of the rural students or students, and so we get their opinions on these issues as well as educators.
Oh, wonderful idea. Okay, thank you. Okay, thank you. As I've looked at education in the past, I really do see a desire on the part of leaders and all wanting to involve the culture and the standards, but it seems like that the culture is always an add-on. Maybe Friday afternoon, we'll have somebody come in and do nets, and we've never yet quite mastered integrating, the local referent and what we're trying to teach. And if we can do that, I think we're winners. I think that's exactly what needs to happen. So,
Representative
Feige.
through the chair, thanks, Mr. Chairman. And getting kind of back to what the chairman is referring to, my experience in the educational system in rural Alaska has mostly been flying the teachers around as part of air taxi or scheduled airlines or whatever. One of the problems that I saw over the years was just the ability of the schools to retain those teachers in those rural school districts. Part of being able to teach the culture is to know the culture, and quite frankly, that takes a little bit of time for somebody, you know, like I did, coming in from outside and being able to learn kind of, you know, what's really going on out in some of these villages. And I know this has been a concern for educators within the state over the years, but how much success have the school districts in general had with retaining people in these teaching positions over a significant amount of time, as opposed to just the high turnover that I seem to see, especially in the YK Delta?
Through the chair, Representative Feige, I think it's various levels of being able to retain teachers for a long time. A couple of points that I think are worth making. We do have a report that is provided to the legislature in February that actually looks at turnover rates and issues around that. So we'll be able to provide to you current data once that report is completed and delivered in the, I believe it's by February 15th, but I'll make sure that the committee chair has a copy of that so that it can be shared. One of the things in the last couple of years, I've talked to a number of rural districts that have been able to retain teachers more so the last couple of years than previous years. That might be related to the economy, at least that's what they believe. But how do we do that when the economy is good everywhere in the country is an issue. And I think making sure that we provide better training when teachers are coming in. Districts, I think, are doing some pretty amazing things in some cases. A couple of years ago, first off, we somewhere between 25% to 30% of our teachers, maybe slightly more or less than that, come from within our state. They come from our teacher education preparation programs. The rest come in from out of state. We simply do not have enough teachers in the state. So, especially when you're bringing teachers in from out of the state. I was one of those. I came up in 1986, got off the plane. The only thing I found one picture of Hooper Bay in a National Geographic magazine. So that's all I knew about Hooper Bay before I arrived. And there was no internet that you could depend on. So that was my view. I had no idea what I was flying out to when I flew my small airplane from Bethel out to Hooper Bay. I think this, and I don't remember the district doing as much at that time, simply because they probably got teachers more easily at that point. But I know Bering Strait School District is the first one I heard do this. I know others have done this, where they do a lot of work to orient that teacher before they arrive. But then they were shown on the news, not this last year, maybe it was a year prior, of all the work they were doing to help them orient to what you need to ship out to yourself before you go out there, and those kinds of things to prepare. So really building much more supports around them before they arrive. So those are things that local districts are doing, and I think many of them doing really quite well. I want to point out an example of another district this last summer. They actually invited all their new teachers to come and spend 3 weeks in the village in June. And should any teacher at that conclusion of that time step up and say, I shouldn't have done this. I got into something I shouldn't have. The superintendent said I was going to release them without penalty from their contract. Only one teacher did that, but one realized, I'm bringing family here, that this isn't what I thought it was. I thought that was a pretty powerful opportunity. Does it have to be 3 weeks? I don't know how long it had to be. They looked at doing that program. They did it on their own and put that in place. So that was powerful. Can everyone do that, or does everyone do that? They don't, but I think districts are trying some powerful things. A last example, because I just think it's powerful when locals come up with these incredible things to do. The Lake and Peninsula School District, they go out and find people the prior year who have just finished their teacher ed program somewhere that graduate early, maybe at January, and they bring them in to do tutoring for their students prior to testing. And then they go to those, if it worked out well, and they found a match, that's the first people they interview and get in their pool of candidates for getting regular teaching jobs the next year. And they found some particular teacher education schools in the lower 48 that they go to every year to bring these folks up. So incredibly, incredible ideas. And then one piece systematically that we're trying to do is in statute, educators, when they come to the state, are required to take a multicultural education course and an Alaska history course. Well, we have allowed people to do anything you want for the most part. Get on that list and be able to teach lots of different things. But is it really preparing people for what that was intended to? We don't think so. So the teacher quality group has is doing some efforts around that to give those courses some specific focus, almost a syllabus. If you want approval to teach this course, which universities usually seek that approval, or other professional development agencies, this is what it must include so that it provides a better experience to get at the issues so you at least know what you're walking into. So I can't say that there's absolute rosy picture around all of that, but I can say districts are making efforts, and then the state is doing the last piece that I mentioned as an effort to try to get at some of those issues.
I'm excited. We're at the second meeting. We're already doing good. We're already focusing in on some of the really important important issues. I can see us having a whole meeting just about teacher retention and quality of teachers and how to support and encourage the teachers. So I hate to let you go, but your time's up. I really appreciate your presentation, and we're all going to have to do some homework here, and you'll be back here on Wednesday. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, thank you, and we'll take a brief at ease. Thank you. Well, last meeting, I think we all had it was a pretty enjoyable time. We really got to understand each other and where we're coming from. And my hope is that those that weren't here will look at the video of that. And I asked Representative Feige if this morning he would just be willing to address those six questions on his part. And not to put any pressure on time, Representative Kawasaki can do it some other time when we have a good block of time and nobody feels rushed. So, Representative Feige, if you wouldn't mind to go through those six questions and any way you'd like to address them.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Number one is a brief biography and personal history of my own education. I grew up about an hour north of New York City and I went to school in the public school system. It's a very good system, a little bit different than Alaska because the school district was its own entity. The school district had its own board and it had its own taxing authority. So there was local politics really didn't have anything to do with it. It was a school board. It was all staffed by volunteers. They came up with a budget, got it approved by public vote, and then they had a staff and everything that took care of hiring their own teachers. It was not a union school district. And it ran very well. The community as a whole was valued education to a high degree, and we had taxes to prove it too. I think in my high school class, 87% of the graduates, 252 graduates, 87% went on to college. Myself, I graduated high school in 1979, and received an appointment to the Military Academy at West Point. Did my 4 years there, it was a good education. Later on, when I attended grad school at Penn State, it was very evident that it was a good education because I knew just the depth and breadth of subjects that we were taught there. Certainly adequately prepared me for a career as an Army officer and also prepared me to deal with all kinds of things in my professional and personal life later on. I got a master's degree in geography at Penn State. That was in preparation for going back to the military academy to teach, which I did for the last year of my military service. And so I have some experience teaching. I must admit, though, any high school teacher that I ever talked to, it's an unusual circumstance for teaching because all your students have to be there. They have to show up at class. They have to do their homework. And they have to pass the course or they're gone. So it really was quite an easy teaching assignment. Why did I choose to serve on the House Education Committee? Well, I think when you take on one of these jobs, you're trying to do something to further the future of your state. The future of the state of Alaska is dependent on the people that are growing up now. And the best way to ensure that they can significantly contribute to that future is that they have a good education. So it's one of the main motivations, I suppose, for serving on the committee. My personal educational philosophy, it is a competitive world out there. And students will have to compete at one level or another to either for resources or they will have to compete in all aspects. Those who choose not to compete will end up falling by the wayside. It's our job as a state and as a state educational system to ensure that they have the tools that they can use to compete. And that means, in the case of not only just the students, but the teachers have to be able to compete as well. They're competing against other teachers to put out a product that is able to accomplish the mission that we give them, which is to educate the students. My own skills and experience that I bring to this, a short year of teaching in a formal classroom, several years of, once I got out of the Army and started a flying career, one of the ways to get going was to do a lot of flight instruction. So that's a little bit different, a little bit more pressure on the instructor to perform. But it also teaches you how to deal with, pilots don't come from the same piece of cloth. They have widely differing educational backgrounds, so you have to be able to teach to those different backgrounds. One of the things you learn is that there's any particular thing that you need to teach somebody so that they know how to fly. A particular task can be taught about three or four different ways, mm-hmm. and that which method you use to convey that task is always dependent on who you're talking to. Mm-hmm. So, as the instructor, you have to be able to adjust your own delivery to match the person that you're trying to try to teach. And I think teachers in the classroom have to be able to do the same thing as well. What good things are happening in education in Alaska today? Well, I think, especially the answer to my last question there, some of the problems that we have, and talking about the cultural things specifically, a lot of our teachers do come from outside, 75%, according to the deputy commissioner here. The only way they're going to be able to, they have to be able to learn the culture first, which means they need to be able to stay in that culture for a significant amount of time. So, and the efforts that he described here a little bit ago, a lot different than what had been done in years past. So, not only you see that not only in the education, but you see it in other industries as well. When you hire somebody from outside, try to make sure that they know exactly what they're getting into, and to give them as much of an opportunity to learn about that before you start committing significant monies money and effort to having them do that job. One of the problems I think that I could see here in the educational system is it's an effort on a lot of people to try to be everything to everybody. Mm-hmm. Try to, and the hazard that you face there is you tend to defocus what you're trying to do. I think it's important that we take and really decide what it is exactly that we want to accomplish and then point everybody in that direction. And instead of trying to be everything to everybody, we have to decide that we want to do this and this has been, and go ahead and do it instead of diffusing your efforts across the entire spectrum of education. And that's about all I have, unless you guys have any questions of me.
Representative Kawasaki, we have 17 minutes. Is that enough time for you to
respond? We need at least a couple hours.
if you wouldn't feel rushed between now and the end of the session, you could share your thoughts, or if you need more time, we could just wait till we make time for you in another meeting.
Oh, I guess I could do it right now. It's fine.
Okay.
Just a brief biography. My parents came to the University of Alaska. I guess it was not the University of Alaska Fairbanks yet, but to attend graduate school in the 60s, mid-60s. They loved the place. They bought a house here, knowing that they would want to come back and raise a family here in Alaska. So when I was a kindergartner, moved here to Fairbanks, went through K through 12 there, graduated from Lathrop, went to school up on the hill, at UAF and got a degree in biomedicine. I'm sure my parents really wanted me to go off to medical school instead of getting into politics, but I got involved in politics and sat for two terms on the city council in Fairbanks, and now this is my third term here in the legislature. I really wanted to, you know, focus on education as an equalizer. I think it's a way for people to become better citizens, better people, better workers, I think that it's a cure to so many economic and social ills that a person can just rise by finding education and doing a good job through the system. I think we've got some significant problems with the system right now. I think that I graduated from high school in 93, and at that point we were starting to teach to tests a lot, and I think that that's a significant problem. I'll tell you, I graduated from high school. I was a bit of an overachiever, as you can imagine. I carried a briefcase to school. I took every AP class that was out there. I wore a tie in high school, too, and I did it probably at a 4.0 coming out of high school. And I went off to college, and I did very badly in college. And I think that, you know, as we talk about the scholarships that are coming up here, or the college scholarship issue that comes up, that that we look at that, that it's not always the straight A students that are the best performing college students. It's going to be some that were just average, and I hope that we take that into consideration when we have that discussion. Let's see. I've been a real big advocate for the last 4 years on pre-K issues. I brought up a couple questions here because I think that if we can identify the serious problems, learning disabilities and things like that at an earlier age, then they're better off and better set for a career in education. And K through 12 works out better in the end. And so I'll be pushing big pre-K issues. Right now there's about 1% of the Department of Education and Early Development budget is spent in early ed, and I think that that's wrong. I think we ought to spend a little bit more on the early part. Let me think. What else? You know, I think there are a lot of good things happening in Alaska today. I mean, we're getting out there when it comes to laptops in schools, the ability for one to learn about things that are going on in cultures across the world. Has expanded. I mean, we could talk with kids up in Barrow, just like that. And that's a pretty amazing thing. So we'll probably be talking about those sort of targeted investments, I think. The Alaska Association of School Boards was here just recently pushing their big digital learning package. And I think that that's those are great things to come. The education is part of the Constitution. It's one of the four guaranteed principles. It's the public safety, public health, education, and infrastructure. I think, if we realize that and realize our constitutional obligations to education, then we're going to be setting this legislature up for a good direction. Let's see, and I think that's about it. So it didn't take an hour.
Thank you. Is any other committee members have any questions with either of these two? Oh. Representative, go ahead.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have any questions, but I wanted to make a comment. We came to Alaska in 93, and my husband had applied for a job in Kotzebue. And them knowing that I was a legislator and was resigning to move to Alaska, they wanted to interview me and wanted to know why I was willing to come up there. And neither one of us had ever been to Alaska. And they just didn't want to chance it because of that, because they said they were really worried about us not being ever in Alaska, and they thought we'd get here and then say, you know, it's not worth it or something, you know. And so we planned our next vacation to come to Alaska so that we could say we've been here, you know. But they do, the schools do look at that. And my husband is interviewing people for Wrangell schools right now. He's trying to get the next superintendent as he leaves this in July, and he talks with both the husbands and the wives just to make sure that they know what to expect and everything, and I think that's a good that they do that. And so anyway, I just thought I'd add that was in 93 that they were making those type of decisions even then, because they had had people come, and after they were there like 4 weeks, the wife was saying, "Man, I can't stand it here. There's no shopping centers and you know whatnot," and would want to turn around and go back. And we ended up spending. He got a job in Tok, and we lived in Tok for 4 years.
So. Reminds me of a story that was a woman from McGrath, and she had a friend, from an urban area outside, and she said to her friend said to her, "Do you have a mall in McGrath?" And the woman from McGrath said, "Yeah, but it's buried in the snow." She was referring to a splitting mall, you know. So, so anyway, the two different types of malls there. Okay, and we will hear from Representative Sisson at some point. I'm really impressed. I mean, she's paddled canoes down the Yukon River, checking villages and whatnot. She's very committed to getting a view of what goes on off the road. So, let me take a look here. Next Wednesday. On one of these pieces. Okay, Wednesday meeting will be 8 to 9 o'clock. It'll be a joint meeting with the Senate Education Committee in room 124. It won't be here. It'll be room 124. Wednesday, 8 to 9, Ramona Barnes, Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education, be a joint session with the Senate Education Committee. And 9 to 10, we'll be back here again, and we'll continue with the Department of Education and Early Development and the... And they'll finish up the presentation with us. So any questions you might have in the meantime, and I know I have a few budget questions, or we might be able to regroup our thoughts. So any other comment, questions? Meeting adjourned.